us. Parker's eyes started to trail off again. I need transportation back to the States. Andrews was taken aback. Parker's speech was in a desperate, commanding tone. For almost a week, I have tried to obtain a ticket, Parker explained. He started to nervously shake his right hand. There's a damn coal strike in London. Almost every ship is locked in her berth with no fuel. That is unfortunate. Unfortunate, yes, Parker mused. The silence of Andrew's home was suddenly interrupted by the sounds of an approaching coach from outside. Parker stiffened and then relaxed as the cab continued on. Parker took a deep breath and met his friend's eyes. He smiled. Thomas, he said almost casually, you've put on some weight. Andrews, confused, let out a sly giggle as he patted his stomach. Married life will do that to you. Married? Parker's face started to glow. It was the first time he actually began to see what was around him. When did you rate having a wife? Been married a long time. We're euphoric. Andrews started to fidget, thinking about his appointment. Dennis, this is all so irregular. He paused, again looking at his watch. Why is it so important that you return to the States now? I mean, you've been away for such a long time. Parker remained silent. Dennis, what the hell have you gotten yourself into? The discovery of a lifetime. Andrews was startled to see the complete rapture behind his friend's expressions. This discovery has sent you to me, at this hour, with men shooting at you. Parker sighed. I have run into a bit of trouble. Andrews remained silent, though his face showed the concern he felt for his friend. I need your help. You want me to help by booking you on the Titanic? Yes. You must be in more than a bit of trouble if you're willing to board a ship. The alley, Parker started to explain. The men that were shooting at us are after an item I discovered outside the Valley of the Kings. Surely you had the proper permits. Parker shook his head. There was a soldier. He didn't like me. You refused to pay him? No. Parker's tone was sad. The man just wanted me to leave. Years in the field, and he just wanted me to give up the fight. Why? Parker shrugged. Maybe because he could. Who knows? Who is this soldier? Parker cleared his throat. The question raised to the surface a hate seldom expressed by an honorable man. He is an officer of the Egyptian government working for the French authorities. Good heavens, Andrews claimed. Don't tell me you're running from the Egyptian government. No, Parker reassured. He is the farthest star from that ancient body. He is an exploiter. He uses his rank and privilege, a rank he probably bribed or bought to force people to do his bidding. He met his match when he tried to use it against me. Good man. Andrews silently offered his friend a glass of port. Parker accepted gladly, sipping the beverage down. While Andrews was serving the drink, Parker reached into his pocket and pulled out a huge mound of American dollars. Seeing the money, Andrews almost dropped his second round of drinks. He had never seen so much money. I wish to purchase a first-class passage on your ship. Parker pointed to the money. This should be enough for a suite, and the cargo I would bring along. Andrews counted the money. This is indeed strange, Dennis. How so? Are you not terrified of the water? Yes, Parker admitted, uneasy. This is my life we are talking about. Parker paused. I need your help. If you wish, this money should just about cover your passage. I understand you are leaving on her tonight. Yes, Andrews swelled with pride. Since you have the money, why don't you accompany me? No, Parker insisted. There was a darkness in his eyes Andrews couldn't understand. I shall meet you in Southampton. My cargo is there. What, may I ask, is this cargo? A mummy, Parker explained. A 3,000-year-old mummy. A mummy, Andrews said with a perverse curiosity. Parker patted his friend on the shoulder. Thomas. I do deeply apologize for this cloak-and-dagger business I have to put you through. I know that I am not acting myself. I promise, that when I next see you, I will be the Dennis Parker you have come to know as your friend. Andrews was overcome. Think nothing of it, old man. Andrews, thinking about the time, looked at his watch. I can still make my lunch. That is good. I shall see you in Southampton. Southampton. With that, Parker left. Andrews closed his door, locking it immediately. There is a secret here, Andrews thought. Dennis has never been the type of man who could tell a lie. He is just too honest. The product of his Catholic upbringing. Something had frightened him beyond reason, and it is not this Egyptian fellow. There is a hidden horror. Andrews packed his bags, left a note of farewell to his wife, arranging that she should meet him in Southampton, and left. He was running late. He was aware that his wife would be angry, but he had less than 1 hour to reach the Titanic. 7:04 p.m. Harland and Wolff Shipyards. Andrews had the wind knocked from him instantly. For a moment, he thought he was the victim of another adventure, but realized that what was happening to him was real. Four men jumped him. At least he thought it was four. All were interested in his belongings and were probing their sticky fingers into any pocket they could find. In a panic, Andrews scanned the yard for help. No one was to be seen. One of the devils touched his carrying case. "Get your bloody hands off that," Andrews warned, as he struggled against the hold of the other men. The four men, dragging Andrews into the light, seemed surprised to hear such rage coming from the throat of their victim. The gaslight flickered on their faces. They were all Arabs.
"Who the hell do you think you are?" Andrews challenged. "Get your hands off of me. I'll call a constable."
Andrews' mouth suddenly fell silent. A knife was at his throat. The blade dug deep into his flesh, ready to cut if need be. The blade was curved and highly shined, the weapon of a skilled professional.
"You will keep quiet. Do you understand, Englishman?"
an Arab hissed. Andrews moaned.
"I do wish you chaps would stop calling me English."
All four Arabs holding Andrews next to the gaslight pole began to laugh. They seemed to be waiting. Waiting for what?
"Mr. Andrews."
The voice had an eerie scratch to it as it rolled from the darkness. Andrews turned his head left, then right. He couldn't see who was addressing him.
"Yes."
Embarrassed as he was, Andrews tried to control his shaking knees.
"A pleasure to meet you, sir."
The ugliest man Andrews' eyes had ever beheld stepped out of the darkness. Overweight, the man was an Arab like the others. The man grinned, moving a fat finger over a thin black mustache. A set of yellow teeth greeted him.
"I am General Sahish."
The Arab smiled with relish.
"You are now my prisoner."
"Prisoner? Under what charge, sir?"
"Under the prosecution that you are hiding a man who has committed crimes against the Egyptian people."
Sahish moved in closer, challenging Andrews with his authority.
"You are in Ireland, sir."
Sahish smiled.
"Yes," he said. "Death is death, no matter where you are standing."
Sahish pulled out a sharp knife. He placed the blade next to Andrew's skin, adding to the Irishman's horror.
"It doesn't matter. You will tell me what I need to know."
"I know nothing," Andrews insisted.
"Where is Dennis Parker?"
"I know no such man."
The knife started to cut Andrew's skin. The shipbuilder began to pray silently.
"You, sir, are lying. I delivered mail to Parker's tent. There were letters from you."
Sahisha's horrid breath attacked Andrew's nostrils.
"Where is he?"
Staring into the crazed eyes, Andrews realized he'd probably be killed no matter what he said. Sahish stepped back.
"Let go of him," he ordered his men. "Now."
The four men holding Andrews gave their master a confused gaze. Sahish, seeing that his men were not complying with his orders, yelled at them,
"Fools! Do as I say!" "My apologies, Mr. Andrews," Sahish said. "We are new to your land and do not know all of the customs."
Andrews grabbed his case from the men. He held it and brushed the imaginary dust from his jacket.
If you have a complaint to file, he growled roughly, you do it through our government.
I was hoping to avoid that, sir.
Dennis Parker has done you no harm. Leave him alone.
Sahish gave Andrews a knowing grin.
Then you do know him.
Andrews' eyes widened, realizing his mistake. Sahish snapped his fingers and silently pointed toward the Irishman. Again, the four men held the shipbuilder to the gaslight pole.
You will tell me where Parker is,
Sahish said stiffly as he slowly pulled a pair of black gloves from his pocket.
I do not wish to hurt you, sir,
he added, slipping the gloves on.
Go to hell,
Andrews said, raising his chin in defiance.
I have already been there, Mr. Andrews.
Sahish began to pummel him, and it seemed to grow in energy as Andrews grunted out in pain.
Keep hitting, man, Andrews spat. You will get nothing from me.
Where is Parker?
Andrews remained silent. Sahish stopped.
You have a strong will, Sahish said. Although a redeeming quality, it's rather a fatal one.
Andrews gave Sahish a cold stare. He shifted his weight from one foot to the other and rubbed his stomach. When he did this, a small brown sack fell from his coat pocket.
What is this?
Sahish asked, stooping and picking up the bag. Andrews panicked.
Nothing. Give it to me.
If it is nothing, why does it make you worry so?
Eyes widened with amazement when Sahish discovered that the bag was filled with money. Andrews thought he heard a subtle chuckle come from Sahish.
Well, Sahish said, Parker wants you to buy a ticket for him on your boat.
It's a ship.
Sahish put the bag of money in his pocket. His face had the look of finality on it.
I'll ask this one more time. Where is Parker?
Silence.
Very well, Sahish said.
He nodded to one of his men.
Kill him.
He turned and walked away. The men holding Andrews began to tighten their grip. An Arab took a knife from the pocket of his freshly pressed trousers. Andrews closed his eyes and began softly reciting the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven.
A voice tore through his brain.
Stop what you're doing to that man.
Andrews' eyes blinked open. The sounds of several police whistles filled the air.
Help! Over here! Andrews called out.
The Arabs let go and ran. Andrews swung his carrying case, attacking those who had held him captive.
Bloody heathens!
He yelled, swinging his case in the air. A man in a naval uniform attacked Sahish. The two struggled for a few minutes. Sahish, hitting the officer, managed to escape. As he disappeared behind a wall of Belfast fog, his curses hung in the air. Lightoller picked up the bag of money, handing it back to Andrews.
Are you all right, Mr. Andrews?
Lightoller asked.
I saw what was going on here and thought that you could use some help.
Andrews' face beamed with appreciation. Shaken, he was relieved to see that his savior was the second officer of the Titanic.
Mr. Lightoller, your timing couldn't have been more appreciated. I thank you, and so does my family.
All in my duty, sir, Lightoller smiled. I'm sworn to protect my passengers.
Andrews opened the bag of money. It was all there.
What is that?
Lightoller exclaimed. He gave Andrews the same look Andrews had given Parker.
Did you spark a wealthy Yankee widow?
Andrews gave the officer a confused look. Typically, such questions into one's personal life would have been considered rude. However, Lightoller did risk his life to save Andrews and had the right to know.
No, Mr. Lightoller,
Andrews explained as he returned the money to his pocket.
A dear friend of mine wishes to accompany us on our maiden voyage, and this is the money for that ticket.
Talk to the purser when you board.
A constable, holding a knife, looked as if he had some bad news. Andrews, by studying the man's face, realized that the men who attacked him had gotten away.
Constable?
Andrews asked. The officer's embarrassment was as evident as Andrews' irritation at his failure.
Sorry, mister, the constable explained. My men did try to hold them, if only we had the proper means. Don't torture yourself, Andrews reassured. These men had specialized training. They know how to slip through the cracks.
Lightoller and Andrews left the policeman alone with their failure. Andrews provided an address where he could be contacted if need be. It was 8 p.m. The Titanic was getting ready to embark. Victoria Channel, Titanic, 8 p.m.
Captain's log, April 2nd, 1912. MGY, RMS Titanic, Captain Bartlett in command. I have set sail on an overnight trip to Southampton. The ship is in top form. I have about 570 miles to go before reaching port. Weather is clear. We will reach port around midnight, April 3rd.
8:10 p.m., Belfast Harbor. General Sahish stood helpless as he watched the Titanic leave her port. His last and only chance to stop Parker, and it was growing smaller as the ship disappeared from view. Parker's discovery would have guaranteed Sahish a wealthy retirement. He had grown tired of diplomacy and wished only to be left alone. Let some other devil fight his way to the top. He just wanted money and the luxuries it could afford. Upon the Titanic's leaving, Sahish learned the ship would be docking in Southampton for a week. That gave him until April 10. Sahish was forming a plan. Accompanied by his secretary Solomon, who had proven to be a useful thief, Sahish was pleased to learn that his man knew the Southampton ports as well.
"You have seen this Southampton port?" he asked his aide Solomon.
"Yes. Yes, I have even worked there," Solomon proclaimed, "as a boy."
Sahish, keeping his eyes on the disappearing Titanic, continued his questioning.
"How is the security?"
"Simple," Solomon smiled. "Easy enough to steal Parker's cargo, if need be."
"The need is there."
The men were startled by the whistle blasts coming from the Titanic. Three blasts of steam towered above the ship.
"Fantastic vessel, isn't she?" Solomon asked.
Sahish nodded in agreement. He might have hated the ways of the Western world, but he could not deny the fact that their science was different from the ones practiced in his land. At the moment, all he could think about was Dennis Parker. Chapter 4. Southampton, England, Titanic, April 10, 1912, Sailing Day. Captain Edward J. Smith, Commodore of the White Star Line, boarded the Titanic with a feeling of trepidation. In all his years at sea, he had seen all species of vessels, from sail to steam. The Titanic was beyond anything he had ever commanded.
"Mr. Murdoch,"
Smith shouted, walking up one of the many passageways leading to the ship.
"Coming, sir."
Smith ran his fingers through his ash-gray beard, studying his new ship's lines.
"White Star's got something with this one," Smith proclaimed. "Although identical to the Olympic, this one seems to grab at you."
First Officer William Murdoch gave his captain an understanding nod. Smith could see that he agreed completely. What sailor at one time in his career hadn't been captivated by the powers of a particular ship? Some called it love.
"I think I will like her, Mr. Murdoch," Smith beamed.
"It's a beauty," Murdoch marveled.
"There is no doubt. Have we received our sailing orders yet?"
"No, sir."
Smith stepped off the gangway to face his number one. On his face was the irritation usually associated with that of command. He was so proud of the fact that he was trusted with the company's flagship so close to retirement. He wanted everything to be perfect.
"Why not?"
he asked Murdoch hard. Murdoch looked into his captain's ancient eyes. The first officer was at least a foot taller than his captain, but Smith's stare made him feel small.
"Second Officer Lightoller is in the radio shack as we speak."
"Good,"
Smith projected with a confident tone.
"Will he have my orders?"
"If he doesn't, sir, I'll find them."
He winked. Smith let out a little laugh.
"Excellent. Are my officers on board at least?"
Smith and Murdoch passed the huge arched windows of the ship's gymnasium. Murdoch handed his captain a list of crew personnel. Smith slowed his walking, swiftly taking the list. The ship, although docked, seemed to throb with power. Smith marveled at the vibrating sensation that was coming up from his shoes.
He looked at his first officer, responding with fascination.
"What a magnificent ship," Smith said, rather absent-minded.
"Sir."
"I was just thinking aloud, Number One."
Smith admired Murdoch's record and knew that if he were to cross the Atlantic in such a vast and complex vessel, he would need a man who knew how to pilot them. Although Lightoller was the White Star's first choice, Smith thought that he lacked command style. Given 10 years at sea, however, Lightoller would be an excellent commander.
"Most of the officers spent the night," Murdoch explained, "getting to know the ship."
Smith shook his head with admiration.
"Commendable."
Below on the dock, the first signs of the voyage were becoming apparent. Crates filled with one wardrobe or another littered almost the whole length of the ship. Horses fought with motor cars for places to park. A curious crowd was starting to form, ready to take the paid tour White Star was famous for. All in a day's work.
"It's going to be a madhouse, Mr. Murdoch."
"Yes, sir."
Smith continued to read his officer's list, stopping when he came to Lightoller's name.
"Any problems with Lightoller?"
Murdoch gave his captain an edgy look.
"He took it hard, sir. He wanted to be first officer as bad as I did."
Smith shook his head with understanding.
"I would as well if I were in Lightoller's shoes."
Smith paused, continuing to read his officer's list.
"Life at sea is like that on land, Mr. Murdoch."
"Sir?"
"You have to learn to take the good with the bad."
"Yes, sir."
Murdoch, noticing his watch, pulled out his own ship's schedule, which he kept in his hat.
"Captain, we need to go down to the purser's office."
"Purser's office?"
Smith's eyes narrowed with surprise.
"Lloyd's is delivered in a package that requires your signature. A book, I think. She's coming with us to America."
"Indeed."
"Yes,"
the first officer explained.
"It's being sold to a wealthy collector. Unmade, gold inlaid, and even has precious stones embedded in its design."
"What's the name of this book?"
The first officer studied his schedule, saying,
"It's a special edition of the Rubaiyat by Omar Khayyam."
"This is going to be a unique voyage, Mr. Murdoch," Smith said, amused.
"It has promise, sir."
The officers headed for the purser's office. Southampton Dock, Passenger Entrance, 9:55 a.m. Bruce Ismay, managing director of the White Star Line, pulled up in a black sedan and peered out his window with a sense of accomplishment. The Titanic was his ship.
"I do wish you would reconsider, love," Ismay said as he patted his wife's hand. "This voyage will be the toast of Europe."
"Bruce, dear, you know that we have had this trip planned since last fall," Ismay's wife insisted as she held back her tears. "Wales is waiting. Besides, I do not hold kindly to the idea of seasickness."
Ismay turned to face his wife.
"My dear, the Titanic and her sister ship, the Olympic, were constructed to avoid that very symptom. There is no way you will get sick."
Ismay stopped, holding back a laugh.
"She is just too big."
Ismay's wife considered, but had made up her mind. She and her children would be going to Wales. That was final.
"You have enough to do without me."
She kissed her husband on the cheek.
"Don't let me take any of this away from you. You have worked so hard. I think your father would be proud of his son today."
Ismay held back his surprise and tried to control his tearing. He placed his bowler on his head, opened his door, and stepped out. With his manservant and secretary following him, Ismay said farewell. Although he was not taking his family, he would not be traveling alone. As the clock struck 10, Ismay, after ordering manservant and secretary aboard to see to his comforts, stood watching passengers as they started to board the ship. Men and women from all ages and classes stood in awe, caught up in the fascination the ship seemed to inspire. What a day to remember. The Titanic was indeed his lifetime achievement. His grandchildren would be talking of this voyage long after he was gone.
"Excuse me, but could you tell me where the second-class passenger entrance is?"
Ismay turned in the direction of the voice. Ismay gave the middle-aged man standing before him a look of disgust. Although an honorable man, Ismay had an intolerance. People below his class.
"Pardon me?" Ismay
asked between grunts.
He made it clear to his intruder that he had better things to do than to relate with the riffraff. The man wore a simple suit, stood an average height, and by all appearances was a common man. There hung about his features a bookish look, sometimes associated with learned men or teachers.
"Oh, I'm terribly sorry," the man said as he tipped his hat. "My name's Lawrence Beasley. I recognized your face from a notice in the Strand the other day. Are you not Mr. Bruce Ismay of the White Star Line?"
Ismay's face started to thaw its bearing. He was actually flattered that someone whom he had never met would appear from the crowd to congratulate him.
"Good sir," Ismay proclaimed as he offered his neighbor his hand. "I am he. How may I be of service?"
Beasley took Ismay's hand, shaking it with an air of excitement. Bruce almost winced from the force of the man's grip.
"I am lost, Mr. Ismay," Beasley laughed.
A tint of blush, pointing out the April chill and his embarrassment, dominated Beasley's features. One could see that he was more than happy to find someone of authority who could be a guide. Ismay, although in a hurry to see the captain, thought it best to help. After all, this man may know a friend who fortune had smiled upon and offer suggestions of a positive nature regarding his limited exposure to the White Star Line.
"Your servant, sir." "Appreciated. How may I help?"
Beasley showed Ismay his ticket, saying,
"I can't find the second-class entrance."
Ismay noticed the card. He knew it well. Several victims of a coal strike had carried them to White Star and Cunard, White Star's primary competitor for possible replacements. The Titanic was carrying several of these people. Ismay's frame suddenly changed. On another ship, this Beasley would be a first-class passenger, but since the Titanic's price was higher, most could only afford second. Maybe he had been wrong about the man. Ismay shifted his walking stick into his left hand, took off his right glove, and pointed to the aft of the vessel.
"Over there, Mr. Beasley."
Beasley turned in the direction Bruce Ismay pointed and spotted a rather long ramp extending from the wooden masonry of the dock to the black, white, and gold-lined iron walls of the Titanic. An enormous white banner proclaiming, "Second-class passengers only," stood out embarrassingly clear. Beasley dropped his head with a heavy sigh, laughing.
"I feel such the fool. All I had to do was look."
"Nonsense," Ismay chuckled as he joined the man in his embarrassment.
"Can happen to anyone. Glad to be of help."
His champion suddenly ignored Beasley, extending his hand in gratitude. He had gotten tired of the man.
"Hope to see you on board," Beasley said.
Ismay, walking away, did not reply. If at all possible, it would be the last encounter he would have with any second-class passengers.
"Mr. Ismay," another voice called.
Ismay rolled his eyes before turning. His irritation changed when he realized it was Thomas Andrews calling him.
"Mr. Ismay, please."
Thomas Andrew grabbed Ismay by the shoulder. Ismay's eyes looked at an overworked young man who had in his hands a mound of blueprints. Ismay was pleased. With Andrews, this was a standard sight.
"Andrews," Ismay exclaimed with genuine glee. "You devil, what have you been up to?"
"Troubles."
Ismay laughed. Andrew's eyes were tired, but he never dulled at watching the director of the White Star Line laugh. Ismay's face had been made for two things, pouting and smiling. It was not that often that he had a chance to witness the latter.
"What's wrong this time? Are the cooks setting the ovens too high?"
Ismay chuckled.
"Nothing that simple,"
Andrews insisted, directing Ismay's attention to his blueprints.
"They just came from the beak heavens. The tower rings have too few screws in them, and the hat hooks far too many. Can you please tell me how in the bloody hell this happened? This didn't occur with the Olympic."
Ismay ruffled.
"Andrews," he huffed. "This is my ship now. Your concern is no longer necessary."
He gave Andrews a challenging look. For an instant, Andrews thought he saw a flash of red in the director's cheeks. Was he actually mad at Andrew's insistence, or was he embarrassed at the fact that he still cared for Ismay's ship? Whatever the reason, the shipbuilder could see a dark secret growing in Ismay's eyes. He wondered what it could be.
"Well then," Ismay blurted out as he started walking away, "let's get to New York."
Over his shoulder, he added,
"See you on board, Mr. Andrews." "Looking forward to it."
Ismay pushed an unsuspecting fish-and-chip seller out of his way and headed off toward a fancy gangway that was brightly entitled First Class Passengers Only. The fish and chip seller threw crumbs of baked fish in the air, giving his attacker curses that would have blushed the hardest sailor into reformation. Andrews could do nothing but laugh. The arrogance of the business types was always a sight to see.
"You should never laugh at your customers," a voice behind him warned.
Andrews thought he was alone. He turned. Dennis Parker stood behind him, softly smiling.
"Dennis," Andrews said, "how is everything?" "Excellent. Couldn't be better."
Andrews gave his friend a curious look.
"Is anybody trying to kill you today?"
Parker laughed and looked at his watch.
"Not yet, but the day is early."
A sly smile crossed his lips. Andrews studied him. One would never believe that the man who stood before him was the same man who had been shot at in the foggy streets of Belfast less than a week ago. Parker looked as if he was back to being the respected professional Andrews had come to know and admire.
"Wonderful."
Andrews returned his friend's smile.
"Where's him in?"
"The man left me 3 days ago returning to his family," Parker explained. "Something about traveling on the ocean."
"Too bad. I rather liked him."
A sad look entered Parker's eyes.
"A good friend. He reminded me in some ways of you."
"Cheer up, old man. You still have me."
"This is true."
Parker turned his attention toward the massive ship in front of them.
"So, this is the famous Titanic."
"Yes," said Andrews with pride. "She is a beauty. I must confess, I fell more for her older sister at the Olympic."
Parker gave him a startled look.
"Why?"
Andrews winked slyly and said,
"One never forgets their first."
The men laughed and Andrews directed his friend toward the first class entrance. Andrews walked up the gangway saying,
"Be prepared to enjoy the voyage of a lifetime."
A boat train, heading toward Southampton, 11:30 a.m. The little girl's green eyes stared at her curious subject with the fascination that can only come from a child. The subject himself was uncomfortable around children, and he hated to be stared at by them. No inquisitor in history could compare his investigative talents to that of the keen scrutiny and innocence of a child. The little girl was of such a beautiful nature, however, that he could not bring himself to ask the mother to correct her. He hoped the girl would grow tired of him and notice the beautiful scenery outside the window of the train's compartment.
"Anna, it's not polite to stare. Leave the man to his reading."
Reginald Cotts, formerly Inspector of Scotland Yard, noticed the rather beautiful mother as she corrected her 5-year-old child.
"My apologies, sir," the mother said to him. "She has had the habit for some time."
Cotts tipped his hat.
"Think nothing of it, madam. Curiosity is an admirable trait. Never suppress it."
Cotts winked at the child. The young woman smiled at him warmly.
"Will you be traveling on the New York?" she asked.
"No. The Titanic."
The mother let out a gasp of excitement.
"How I envy you, sir. The Titanic. Imagine that."
Along with the mother and her child, 3 other people were sharing the car. A businessman of middle age and a newlywed couple embraced in a loving huddle. The Titanic's name caused them all to stare at Cotts. They were all silently measuring themselves up to him.
"I didn't buy the ticket," Cotts explained. "I was booked on the Philadelphia. She was cancelled, however, because of the coal strike. The White Star offered to redeem my ticket on the Titanic if I traveled second class."
The wealthy businessman in the far corner of the cabin suppressed a rather bitter laugh. The curious eyes retreated as fast as they had advanced. Cotts still appeared to have one admirer, though. The child. Cotts cleared his throat. He decided that if he couldn't avoid the child, it was best to confront her.
"Well, love, where are you going?" he asked.
The child shrugged her shoulders and continued to stare at him. Cotts noticed her attention appeared to be focused on his right coat pocket. Cotts reached into his pocket and pulled out an oblong brown bag decorated with red string ties.
"Know what this is?" Cotts asked as he smiled at the girl. "Would you like to see?"
"Yes,"
Anna cried with insistence. The girl tugged at her mother's dress, grabbing her attention.
"Mother, he has a treasure."
The girl's mother followed her daughter's wonder. Again, everyone in the cabin was watching him. Cotts smiled. Approaching 60, he had a rather scarecrow-like frame, which reminded him of the character in Washington Irving's story of the Headless Horseman. His body never had the talent of gaining any weight, so clothes hung loosely about him. Kotz always joked that if he were a wealthy man, he would have been a nightmare to any decent tailor. Kotz opened the bag and pulled out a hand-carved flute. Anna clapped with excitement.
"Oh, please, play it," she begged.
Kotz shifted his weight as he looked at the adult faces around him. Apparently, they did not wish for him to interrupt their silence.
"The others might object, love."
"I don't care," Anna proclaimed.
Kotz laughed. He was starting to feel at ease with this young one.
"I really shouldn't," Kotz explained.
Protests were heard again from the wealthy businessman in the corner.
"They should put the commoners with the other servants," the man said snootily.
Kotz's glare focused on the businessman. Dressed in clothes that would cost a year of his salary, he looked down upon Kotz as if he were a slave. Kotz had known people like these. He had seen far too many times in his police work a poor man before the dock to protect the guilty neck of the wealthy. Anger dashed Kotz's playful mood. He placed his fingers on the flute's major keyholes and held back a smile as he began to play. His eyes met the eyes of the snooty businessman. He silently dared the man to stop him. Southampton Dock, Cargo Department, 11:48 a.m. Sahish watched the bobby as he moved through the holds of Southampton Harbor. If detected, Sahish was willing to kill.
"Where is the crate located?"
Sahish asked Solomon.
"It's near the dock," Solomon said. "You can't miss it. A huge metal case. It is said to be waterproof."
Sahish nodded in acknowledgement.
"You have been a faithful servant, Solomon. A great reward awaits you when the time comes."
Solomon bowed and kissed Sahish's hand.
"Thank you, master."
Sahish shrugged Solomon's praises aside. He wished only to steal what was his to steal.
"There is a policeman over there," Solomon warned, pointing. "Yes, I recognize the uniform," Sahish said thoughtfully. "Go distract him as I steal the mummy."
Sahish laughed.
"I would pay anything to see Parker's face after he discovers that I have Kare's remains."
Solomon's eyes started to fill with fear. Sahish noticed the uneasiness but chose to pay it no heed.
"Master, Kare is evil. Her power, it is said, lives beyond the grave."
In real terror, Solomon pleaded with his employer.
"She will destroy you."
Although a man of Egypt, Sahish considered his beliefs to be more akin to his Western cousins. Science and logic were mixed in with his greed. What's dead is dead. That was final. Sahish took out a gun and pointed it at Solomon's head. Solomon stepped back in surprise and then fell to his knees, grabbing his master's hand.
"I'm sorry, master. I don't doubt your greatness. I am your servant. Seek out the British policeman and lead him away from the crate." "How will you steal a container that is so big?" "That is not your concern," Sahish yelled. "Your concern is to stay alive."
Solomon ran off, stalking the bobby on his rounds. The Arab threw a small rock, hitting the young officer. Solomon showed himself so that the dazed Englishman could see his attacker. They both ran in the opposite direction of Solomon's master and his prize. Sahish watched, marveling at Solomon's cleverness.
"A good man, Solomon," Sahish said. "Too bad that he has to die."
Sahish smiled with anticipation. He started searching for Parker's crate. Told that Kare's coffin had been placed in a watertight case, Sahish believed that the treasure would be easy to find. Sahish put his gun in his holster. There was no need for it now. In the corner of the dock, next to several leather cases, possibly filled with clothes, stood a metal box of rather oblong design. The general fought through boxes and rope, determined to take what was rightfully his.
"Parker will not take Kare," he proclaimed. "She will bring me great wealth on the black market. Never again will I have to kill, steal, or lie for what should be mine."
Sahish approached the crate. With difficulty, he opened the watertight box, gazing upon the ancient sarcophagus within. He was dumbfounded at what he saw. Decorated with the finest colors available in its day, a human-like figure greeted its visitor. Old and forgotten, the colors showed their age. The smell of rotting wood and a chemical not known to Sahish permeated his nostrils. A feeling was there as well. a sense the general was familiar with.
Death. This is strange, Sahish said as he shined a match over the sarcophagus's face.
Although quite beautiful, the sarcophagus held a mystery. The carved image of the human form had no face. It was as if someone wanted to erase Kare's identity. Sahisha's breath started to quicken. Was this how Parker felt when he opened a tomb? Finally, he understood what it was that had driven an American to dig in his native deserts. It was a feeling of control and power that Sahish had never known. Sahish had only 8 inches between him and the ancient sarcophagus. The watertight crate gave the coffin an illusion of being much larger, but upon further investigations, he learned that Kare's final resting place was only 5 feet in length.
How could people who were so small build pyramids that were so big?
Sahish was as jumpy as a child on Christmas morn. He couldn't help but laugh out loud. He didn't care about the police. He didn't care about Solomon. He didn't care about anything. The Arab started to pick the sarcophagus open. He noticed the original scratches caused by Parker.
I wonder why Parker wanted you so.
With a grunt, Sahish opened the ancient coffin.
Impossible!
Sahish screamed, horrified, glaring at the mummy within. Sahish's form started to wrench in pain. As his throat was ripped open, he looked into ancient eyes. They, in their sockets, were looking back. Chapter 5 B-Deck, Suite B-53, 11:50 a.m. Escorted to his first-class stateroom, Parker was pleased to learn that Andrews had acquired for him one of the ship's 4 parlor suites. These suites, although expensive, were among one of the many jewels in the Titanic's crown. Each suite had its own sitting room, 2 bedrooms, 2 wardrobe rooms, private bath, and lavatory. Although far too fancy for Parker, Andrews insisted. His particular suite had been reserved for the American millionaire J. Pierpont Morgan, but at the last minute, the owner of the International Mercantile Marine Company, of which White Star was owned, had fallen ill and could not attend his ship's maiden voyage. Who better to take the place of a prominent American than a fellow countryman?
Here we are, Andrews said as he opened Parker's suite. Under normal circumstances, you would be escorted by a steward, but I ran him off. Thanks.
Parker's eyes were filled with curiosity. It had been quite some time since he had seen anything as rich as this ship. An archaeologist's best friend was usually his tent. Comfort was often found in an army cot. Andrews looked at his friend. The shipbuilder's joy matched his friend's amazement.
You've really outdone yourself this time, Tom, Parker said as he marveled at the enormity of his comforts. Decorated in Louis Kahn's Versailles style with just a touch of the Edwardian.
Parker gave Andrews an approving nod.
Amazing.
Andrews let out a sigh of relief. He felt as if his ship had just passed its most important test. It caught the pleasing tastes of a friend.
Elizabeth is the only one who can compare to her beauty, Andrews said.
Andrews was praising the Titanic with the same love and care a master shows toward a prized dog.
I am glad you find her so.
Parker placed his travel bag on a 4-poster bed.
Elizabeth, Parker asked Andrews. She's your daughter, isn't she? She is my world, Andrews proclaimed. She is worth 1,000 Titanics. I envy you, Tom, Parker said softly.
Andrews noticed a sad tone in Parker's voice and stared at his friend. Parker was lost in himself as if thinking of a faraway event.
Why don't you find yourself a nice girl and raise a family? Andrews asked.
Parker turned from the window.
What? Why don't you raise a family? Andrews repeated with a smile. If anyone can do it, you can. You have more patience and understanding with children than any professional parent I have seen. Women are not my forte.
Andrews looked at his friend with amazement.
Are you trying to see?
Parker gave Andrews a hard look. The right one hasn't come along yet. Andrews realized that he was stepping on some rather personal toes. Parker had always been awkward toward the opposite sex. In school, young boys used to dare the girls. If one could get Parker to kiss them, they would get a 1-pound note.
Keep looking, my friend, Andrews said.
The right one will come.
Parker let out a sad laugh.
Let's go out on deck, he said.
Andrews pulled out his pocket watch.
Yes, it's almost time, he said.
The men left the suite. The Titanic was preparing to leave the dock. Beneath their feet, they could feel the increasing vibrations of the ship's engines. Bridge, 11:55 a.m.
Harbor pilot requests permission to board the vessel, Captain,
Second Officer Lightoller reported to his commanding officer. Smith exited the wheelhouse and approached his second officer.
Mr. Lightoller, isn't it?
Sir,
Lightoller replied, confirming his identity.
You may give permission.
Lightoller left the bridge. While Smith stood, sympathizing with the real disappointment he had seen in the eyes of his second officer, William Murdoch approached him. Murdoch also noticed the emotion.
Lightoller's a good man, sir,
Murdoch said with conviction.
An expert seaman. I have never seen a better at his age.
Smith gave his number one a curious look.
Did I ask you, Mr. Murdoch?
Murdoch's frame shrank.
No, sir, you didn't.
Smith saw that he caused genuine fear to grow among his bridge crew and suddenly broke out in roaring British laughter.
As you were, number one, Smith said,
noticing the confused stare.
I was only joking. Lightoller is a good man, but the Titanic needs better. You know this new breed of ships. Given some time, I'm sure our second will one day toe the line, as it were. Aye, sir.
More relaxed, Smith turned his attentions to the crew.
Since this vessel had the unfortunate destiny of having never been christened, I would like to take this opportunity to say, God bless this ship and all who sail in her.
The bridge crew sighed with relief. It had, for some time, been an unsettling thing among the White Star crews, Smith discovered, to know that they would be sailing on an unblessed ship. It had never been the custom of the line to christen their ships, so the captain thought it his duty to calm the fears. The ringing of the ship's communicator suddenly interrupted the silence of the bridge.
Answer that, Mr. Murdoch,
Smith ordered, as he walked out onto the port bridge wing. Murdoch responded to the phone, saying,
Bridge, Murdoch here.
Murdoch gave his shipmates an affirmative nod.
Send him up, Mr. Lightoller.
Well, number one,
Smith asked from the bridge wing.
Sir, that was Mr. Lightoller. He and the harbor pilot are on the way.
Smith grunted.
I hate harbor pilots, number one.
Yes, sir, Murdoch joked. They think they're captains.
Smith, surprised by his first officer's remark, gave the young man a stern stare. Murdoch, knowing that he had attacked his commander's ego, did his best to hold back an ironic smirk. The Titanic's voyage to the New World was about to begin. Orlop Deck, First and Second Class Cargo Hold, 11:58 a.m. A sudden noise rang through the cargo hold. Wiggins, a baggage handler who signed on board at the last minute, thought that he had heard someone moving around. Like most of the workers on board, he transferred from another ship. He and his former ship's coal were sailing under different captains. The New York had been the latest victim of the strike.
Bloody strikers,
Wiggins cursed, lifting and moving steamer trunks.
Don't they realize that other men have to earn a living? Unions are fine if you have the money, but if you don't, you starve just the same.
The hold again echoed with a strange noise, a sound that did not belong.
Who's up there? Wiggins shouted.
Although the first and second class baggage compartments were dark, he could see shadows coming from the forward holds.
Come on, speak up and be recognized. Captain don't want no mates down here.
Clank.
Could just be noise coming from the second hatch.
Wiggins, trying to mind his own business, went back to stacking baggage. He had a lot to do before the ship reached France.
Clank. Who's that?
Wiggins yelled. No response. Wiggins looked up the pathway to the cargo holds. He blinked his eyes, focusing. Had he seen something? There was movement. There was someone there.
Another damn stowaway. Captain's gonna have a fine time with this one.
Wiggins picked up a hammer and yelled at the noise coming from the adjacent compartment.
Hey, you! Get out to where I can see you.
Silence was his reply.
Come on out. It will go easier on you if you show yourself. Clank. Bloody fool,
Wiggins headed off into the cargo hold. Compared to the cargo holds of the New York, the storage areas of the Titanic made Wiggins' former ship look like an old Chinese junk. Huge rooms, cold, filled with crates bound for the American shores. Words could not describe the large tonnage that greeted the White Star employee.
"Looks like Wimbledon on opening day,"
Wiggins said, awed by the hold's sheer size. The wind whistled through the iron room as Wiggins scanned for an intruder. It was almost impossible for him to distinguish anything. The room was just too big. Shadows, created by the electric lights, played tricks with his eyes. Forms and distortions magnified the dark gray areas between boxes. Although huge, the room could not play tricks with his ears. Something was moving.
"Last warning!"
Wiggins raised his hammer. He fought with the sweat growing on his palms and found it almost impossible to hold the big tool any longer than he had to.
"I'll smash your freeloading head in when I find you. Captain has no room in his heart for stowaways, and neither do I. Come out."
Silence. Wiggins could not trust his eyes. The dim lights saw to that. He had to see with his ears. Every sound haunted him. Every pitch and roll unnerved him. Wiggins' knees began to quake.
"Fool," Wiggins thought. "Never let them take you from behind. Not even out of the dock, and you've already made an ass out of yourself. An excellent addition to the crew you are."
He barely had enough time to turn and attack.
"Hey,"
a rough voice replied. As the hammer came buzzing down, slicing through the air, Wiggins caught a glimpse of his would-be stowaway. It was a fellow crewman. Wiggins realized that the noises he had been hearing had come from a fellow mate hard at work in the next room.
"What in the bloody hell do you think you're doing?"
said Rollins, a cargo officer that had been transferred from the George Washington. He grabbed at Wiggins' hand with a hint of panic in his eyes. Wiggins dropped his hammer and, out of sheer frustration, slapped his laughing co-worker across the mouth.
"Idiot! I could have killed you,"
Wiggins warned. Faced with the knowledge that he had almost killed an innocent man, Wiggins' shaking increased.
"Why didn't you call out when I yelled at you?" "I had to latch down the Renault."
Rollins pointed to a red car not 30 feet from them. As the Titanic pitched, her motion caused several ties to tap against the automobile's metallic skin. The stowaway? Wiggins let out a deep breath of relief.
"Thank the Lord. I thought I'd have to brain someone before the day was over with."
Rollins laughed.
"Why would a man want to take such a lovely thing with him to the States?"
Rollins pointed to the Renault.
"I have sailed both sides of this world, and I've never seen anything stranger than the rich."
Wiggins let out a contemptible laugh.
"Do you know why the rich are different?" "Enlighten me." "Because they can afford to be. Do you honestly think they would have built this ship for men like you and me?"
Wiggins pointed out.
"As long as I have a check waiting for me on the other side, I don't care."
Waving, Rollins continued with his work in a cargo room at the other end of the hold.
"Never knew a rich man who was happy anyway."
Clank. The sound returned. Wiggins realized that he was alone again. Wiggins turned to stare at the Renault.
"I've heard just all I want to hear from you."
Preparing to leave the hold, he hoped to finish his work before dinner.
"Who's that?" he asked, puzzled. "Excuse me, can I help you?"
A shadow was blocking the door. After the episode with Rollins and his hammer, Wiggins would have done anything to avoid looking the fool again, but he was new to the ship and knew only one way out of the hold. The stranger did not reply. Standing silent, the mysterious shadow continued to block the man's way.
"Are you by chance the owner of this car?"
Wiggins asked, moving his hand from car to shadow. Again, silence.
"Talkative, aren't you?"
Wiggins chuckled. The stranger raised his hands and placed them on both sides of the hatch. There was no way of exiting without pushing his form out of the way.
"This is all I need," Wiggins moaned, controlling the volume of his voice. "Some bald, rich bastard bossing me around having his fun. If I bore him, he's sure to report me to the captain."
The stranger tapped his fingers on the passageway as if daring Wiggins to approach him.
"Look," Wiggins warned, "I need no trouble in my life."
A red light located on the hold's main door started to flash. The scarlet glare was a warning to all those below decks.
Wiggins knew it well. The Titanic was getting ready to leave the dock.
"That's the underway warning," Wiggins said as he walked toward his visitor. "Both of us had better get up on deck."
The stranger stepped forward, limping into the light. To Wiggins' surprise, the stranger was a woman.
"Sorry, miss, I thought you were a..."
Wiggins stopped, petrified. A thousand thoughts flashed through Wiggins' mind as he looked up at the stranger's face. The red, flashing light created a rather macabre strobe effect. The woman slowly advanced toward him. Ancient eyes met his, freezing his form with the power of a cobra. Wiggins couldn't take his eyes off the rotting flesh, the mold, or the wrappings. He started to fish for his hammer. He couldn't remember where he had put it. "Dear God, I have gone mad," he mumbled, fearing for his sanity. He tried to scream. It was useless. The horror grabbed at his throat, breaking off the air needed for the sound. Wiggins was at the monster's mercy.
"Please,"
Wiggins managed to force out of his mouth.
"Please!"
The monster, wrapped in ancient cloth of times long forgotten, curiously looked at her prey. As her misshapen head moved, Wiggins noticed that it was completely flat in the back. Thousands of years lying in a coffin had taken their toll. The rest of her, by comparison, was perfect. Not only perfect, but disturbingly shapely. Full breasts heaved with the monster's breathing. Dear God, it was breathing. It was alive.
"Don't kill me,"
Wiggins pleaded, gasping for air. He clawed helpless fingers into the air, panic clearly in his eyes. Ka-Ray saw the fear in her victim's eyes, and she smiled with amusement. A spark of life entered her heart when she realized that even in his terror, Wiggins was silently marveling at the beauty of her body, a body that served her masterfully in life. Wiggins let out one last gasp of air as Ka-Ray ripped his neck open with her long, sharp fingernails. The man tried to scream, falling instead into a pool of his own blood. He struggled to sit up. A strange gurgle burst from his mouth when he saw his blood pooling around him. Gagging back the overflow of blood bubbling into his mouth, Wiggins tried scooping his blood up off the floor and desperately trying to place it back into his wound. It was the last thing Wiggins would ever try to do. A mechanical thunder echoed through the cargo hold. The Titanic's anchors began to rise. Ka-Ray grabbed Wiggins by the ankle. Like a child with a rag doll, she dragged him along the floor, his blood leaving a crimson trail behind. The mummy knew she had to find a place to hide the body. Chapter 6 Orlop Deck, Coal Bunker, Boiler Room Number 6, 12:05 p.m. The fire guided her. Ka-Ray, dragging Wiggins' body behind her, felt the warm air coming from Boiler Room Number 6. She was reminded of the winds of home.
"Shovel hard, men," a voice shouted, coming from the huge room ahead of her.
Ka-Ray cast a spell, for she was a skilled priestess in life, causing her movement to go unnoticed. She slowed her walk, listening.
"The captain's about ready to command the ship," the man's voice continued to say.
The mummy, under cover of magic, limped into the boiler room. Ka-Ray's eyes widened with startled amazement. The iron altars before her were nothing like the temples she knew in her beloved Egypt. These northern men worshipped different gods. Gods of metal. Gods of fire. Huge, single-ended boilers, five in all, blazed heat in all directions. Like ancient gods, these machines demanded servitude and received it from the surrounding men with gratitude. Ka-Ray had never seen the like before. She was amused by the workers, watching them curiously move about in strange clothing, shoveling little black rocks into the gaping hot mouths of their iron gods. Ka-Ray had no idea, but compared to most seagoing vessels, these men were blessed. Older boiler rooms were dirty, but the Titanic was new and held still the luxury of comfort. It had been the grime and danger of previous boiler rooms that had given the stoking teams on board ship the nicknames Black Gangs. Ka-Ray watched these strange men.
"What manner of world have I awoken to?"
she asked herself. No one in the boiler room noticed